This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In the news this week, it was all about a small town in Connecticut and a nation trying to come to terms with the slaughter of 20 children, their teachers, and principal.
The week began with funerals for six-year-olds in Newtown and a call by President Obama for meaningful action to stop the violence. It ended today with a call by the National Rifle Association to put armed guards in schools.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
As the NRA doubled down on gun rights, a renewed debate with renewed passion began on gun control.
The NRA is killing our children. We gotta stop the violence. And violence begins with the NRA stating the true facts that they are the perpetrators of the crimes that are taking place in our schools and on our streets.
Also this week,
I'm very proud to announce my choice for America's next Secretary of State, John Kerry.
A choice that will launch a new race for the Senate here in Massachusetts.
Special elections are creatures of money and organization.
And after a jury found him guilty for the 2010 multiple murders in Mattapan, it's life in prison without parole for Dwayne Moore.
At least somebody is going to jail for it because it was just sickening. Unfortunately, they all couldn't be found guilty, but at least one of them is, so...
Those are among this week's top stories we'll consider now with our Week in Review panel. And joining us is Peter Canellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Peter. Good to have you.
Thanks, Anthony.
Also from Hartford, Connecticut, we're happy to have Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR in Hartford. And Colin, great to have you back on Radio Boston. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you, Anthony.
So let's begin with the fallout from the tragic events in Newtown, Connecticut. 1 week ago today, 20-year-old Adam Lanza allegedly shot his way into the Sandy Hook Elementary School, killed 20 children, their teachers, and their principal. It was the second deadliest school shooting in the nation's history. Today, the National Rifle Association broke its silence and said the best way to protect children from gun violence is by placing armed guards in school. Here's Wayne LaPierre, the CEO of the NRA, speaking today in Washington.
The only way to stop a monster from killing our kids is to be personally involved and invested in a plan of absolute protection. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
So how would that absolute plan work? Well, the NRA named former Arkansas Congressman Asa Hutchinson to design a security plan for schools that would rely on armed volunteers. Here's Asa Hutchinson.
This will be a program that does not depend upon massive funding from local authorities or the federal government. Instead, it'll make use of local volunteers serving in their own communities.
So, Colin, let me start with you there in Connecticut. I'm curious to know what kind of reaction you're hearing to the NRA's proposal today around Connecticut, where this terrible tragedy unfolded.
I had a Board of Education member from one of our larger local towns right here in the building with me right after that happened, and he turned to me and said, just for the record, as a member of the Board of Education, I'm not really interested in having firefights in our classrooms. I mean, there's a level of arrogance implicit in saying, well, we're going to design a plan for our nation's classrooms. They don't have anything to do with our nation's classrooms. They're not a Board of Education. They're not educational officials, and yet... I have to say, just in general, I have been in a very strange mood all week as a result of what obviously everybody's been through. Mm. But there was almost something so clownishly self-imploding about this divisive, defiant performance by LaPierre, this tin-eared performance, you know, just not too many minutes after the national moment of silence. It almost broke the mood. I mean, people in newsrooms around the country, I think, were just looking at this guy and almost laughing in disbelief. The clip that you played is the most forgiving clip that you could play of him. The rest of the speech was so combative, so blaming of everybody but possessors of these crazy guns that it was astonishing.
Mm. Peter, the NRA, of course, represents a powerful lobby that stood for Second Amendment gun rights for a long, long time. They've got millions of members. Any surprise that they've come out with this position now?
Yes. I mean, I was surprised by the vociferousness of LaPierre, and I also feel like he did not do himself any favors. He looked like an extremist. He spoke like a fringy in American politics. He seemed not to get the national mood at all. And I think a lot of people who feel that the NRA sort of, you know, in a parallel position to the ACLU takes absolutist stances, but more or less, you know, is a sincere supporter of individual rights is looking at this guy, the viewers are looking at this guy and saying, wait a minute, the NRA is more of a problem than we thought rather than less of a problem. Mm.
Now, it seems as though the Newtown shootings have begun to change the debate around gun control in this country. President Obama has called for meaningful action. And here's a case in point. Former Republican Congressman from Florida, Joe Scarborough, host of MSNBC's Morning Joe show. He's a conservative Republican with the NRA's highest rankings, ratings. But he says the Newtown shootings changed everything for him. Let's listen.
And our Bill of Rights does not guarantee gun manufacturers the absolute right to sell military styled, high caliber, semi-automatic, combat assault rifles with high capacity magazines to whoever the hell they want.
So, Colin, I mean, gun control has been sort of a dormant issue. We didn't hear a peep about it during the recent campaign. Do you think, in the wake of Newtown, that we are actually going to have a real debate and possibly some real gun control?
Well, I'll precede my comments by saying in the Joe Scarborough clip, Joe Scarborough has had so many bad ideas in his life that he's now developed kind of a cottage industry of walking them back. and so that's sort of one of them. And I think the clip that you played is preceded by the fact that he says, you know, after Columbine, he didn't change his mind at all.
That's
he
right.
He still clung to this libertarian. And I'm thinking, wow, Columbine wasn't enough, huh? That's amazing. But I do think you're right that there's a paradigm shift here. And you listen to the way it's being debated, not just by politicians, but just even listening to the show that we have here on public radio, listening to the number of people who call in and say, you know what, I'm a gun owner. I'm even an NRA member. I've got a shotgun 10 feet away from me here, a loaded shotgun. But I don't believe in these other kinds of weapons, and I don't think anybody needs them. And those people who are gun owners, who are in some cases NRA members, people who have even had to seek out the NRA because they want to be hunters and they want to go through the certification course, and the NRA is one of the few entities to offer it. But then they go there and they get handed a semi-automatic weapon with a big clip, and they say, "Well, no, I want to be the guy out there with two bullets for the deer." And we're hearing from those people in a way we've never heard from them before.
Yeah, Peter, do you think paradigm shift? Are we seeing that out there?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I would be very, very surprised if we don't get some sort of action, some sort of renewed assault weapons ban to come out of this, and as I said before, the NRA is not winning any friends at this moment, and it's hard to see them bouncing back unless things get so protracted that we're like 6 months down the line before anything happens. And it seems like Obama and Vice President Biden are kind of on top of that and want to get something in maybe a month from now.
There was some interesting polling data that came out of the Pew Research Center for the People in the Press just yesterday, and it shows that public attitudes about gun control have shifted. It's a modest shift, but it is a shift nonetheless. 49% say it's more important to control gun ownership, while 42% say it's more important to protect the rights of Americans to own guns. So that's a shift from 5 months ago when Americans were more or less evenly divided on the issue. Peter, to what extent do you think that represents a significant shift, and how it might affect this debate going forward?
I think that those kinds of shifts, you know, we're talking 5 and 10 percentage points, you know, often do make the difference in terms of legislation getting through. And it certainly will make a difference, I think, on the state level, where Governor Patrick's one gun a month plan is coming up for reconsideration. And I would be very surprised if that does not go through.
Well, gentlemen, if we can, let's move on briefly to news about Senator John Kerry, because as expected, today President Obama nominated the senior senator from Massachusetts to succeed Hillary Clinton in becoming the nation's 68th Secretary of State. Kerry's nomination was expected in the wake of course, that fierce Republican opposition to UN Ambassador Susan Rice. Here is President Obama speaking a little earlier today.
Over these many years, John's earned the respect and confidence of leaders around the world. He is not going to need a lot of on-the-job training. He has earned the respect and trust of his Senate colleagues, Democrats and Republicans. I think it's fair to say that few individuals know as many presidents and prime ministers or grasp our foreign policies as firmly as John Kerry, and this makes him a perfect choice to guide American diplomacy in the years ahead.
So, Peter, let's start with you. No surprise here, but and also perhaps the fact that lots of people are saying that Senator Kerry can expect a pretty straightforward confirmation process. But do you think it's a good fit for John Kerry?
I think it's quite a good fit. And I think you know, one thing about John Kerry that has always struck me is the extent to which his interest in foreign policy dates back to the 1960s, which was such a crucible, and the Vietnam War was such a crucible. And his sort of central position leading the veterans against the war in Vietnam and then being the presidential nominee in the midst of Iraq, you know, those experiences, I think, will resonate so strongly with him and really, you know, inform his diplomacy in his time as Secretary of State. Mm.
Colin, what's your view on Kerry as potentially the next Secretary of State?
Well, I mean, there's a part of me that's a little bit amused by the forthcoming Republican affirmation of this guy that they, you know, they couldn't destroy enough in 2004. But because he's not Susan Rice, because they got their way, they had their tantrum, they won. My sense is that he's going to be showered with garlands. And I think for a lot of people, it does seem like it's fitting, it's right. I mean, that's not the reason you pick a Secretary of State, because there's some kind of implied justice after what he went through in 2004. But I think he'll be a fine Secretary of State, and I think a lot of people feel good about that, too.
Mm-hmm. So, Peter, let's talk about what this means for Massachusetts, because, of course, if Kerry does vacate his seat in January, Governor Deval Patrick will pick someone to fill in for him until a special election, probably sometime next spring. So should he choose to run again, is Scott Brown the automatic front runner for that?
I think Scott Brown is a very serious candidate for that. And if he chooses to run again, it'll be almost like a, you know, reintroduction to Scott Brown. And the key question will be, you know, how badly was he damaged by the bruising race with Elizabeth Warren? You know, will a lot of people still be remembering the Professor Warren and the harping on the Native American issue? And, you know, has their view of Scott Brown been permanently tarnished by that race? But all evidence suggests that he's been a little bit tarnished, but perhaps not enough to say that, you know, he shouldn't expect to win a special election.
Well, earlier this week, we spoke with Nancy Dwight. She's former executive director of the National Republican Congressional Committee and also one of our regular political analysts. She believes Scott Brown would be a strong candidate, but that it would be a tougher run for him because Democrats would be ready in a way that they weren't in 2010. So here's Nancy.
My guess is that if the president appoints Kerry, creating this vacancy with the firm knowledge that Scott Brown will be back running again, he's doing it with the understanding that resources will be committed and the organization that we saw in the Obama November election will be ramped up again here in Massachusetts.
And Colin, to add to that, if Scott Brown does run, he's pretty much signing on to what we're talking about here in our office as a permanent Senate campaign. I mean, he won the special election in 2010, then lost this year in 2012. But if he were to win next spring, he'd have to run again in 2014, which is when John Kerry's current term would end. I mean, do you think that would make Scott Brown or any politician think twice about jumping into the race for Senate again?
I don't. And having watched Linda McMahon in Connecticut do essentially the same thing, she ended her 2010 campaign, ran a series of commercials, a series of farewell commercials in 2010, saying, goodbye, goodbye, I'm a job creator, goodbye. I mean, we knew she was coming back. And so, they won't. The people I feel sorry for are you guys. I feel sorry for my journalistic brethren in Massachusetts. I still have post-traumatic stress syndrome from the Murphy-McMahon campaign. If someone told me there was another one starting up in the spring, I think maybe I would move to the Bahamas.
Let alone the voters as well.
Well, finally today, this week, a jury convicted Duane Moore of multiple murders committed in Mattapan back in 2010. They found him guilty of murdering four people, including a two-year-old boy. Suffolk Superior Court judge sentenced him to life in prison without parole. Here's reaction from Michelle Joseph, a resident on Woolston Street where the murders occurred.
At least somebody is going to jail for it because it was just sickening. Unfortunately, they all couldn't be found guilty, but at least one of them is. So.
Meanwhile, Wayne Moore's defense attorney, John Amabile, says he will appeal the verdict.
I'm very disappointed, but I have deep respect for the system of justice and for this jury. And I don't think they made the right decision, but I'm not going to say anything more about it.
So, Peter, Amabile believes that law enforcement was fooled and that the real killer was Kimani Washington, a career criminal who testified against Moore. What do you think of the chances of this appeal?
I don't know. I think that it certainly is an intriguing theory. And when I heard the clip that you just ran of, you know, at least somebody's going to be held responsible for this, that sometimes in these very high-profile murders, these kinds of injustices do occur, you know, mm-hmm. and there's such a desire to convict anybody that problems arise. I mean, I just recently saw the new movie, The Central Park Five, which is a real eye-opener for those of us who lived through that Central mm-hmm. Park jogger case in New York.
This is a Ken Burns film, isn't it?
The
right?
Ken Burns and yep. his daughter, Sarah, and yeah, and it's really good, and it's really thought-provoking, and it makes you look at some of these cases like the Mattapan Massacre with a different set of eyes. So I don't know the facts well enough to say, oh, it's going to get overturned or it could be overturned, but I feel like you know, people should keep a close eye on it.
Right, and we will be. And I have a sense that this story is that we'll be covering the story for a little while to come. With that, let's move on to our hubbub. That story that sort of fell below the fold this week, Colin. Let me come to you for your hubbub.
My favorite, and it's been a very dark week here in Connecticut. This actually did sort of cheer me up. This is a story out of Canada about an inside job in which thieves with access to a warehouse loaded up trucks and over time made off with $18 million of maple syrup. And it turns out that's funny enough all by itself. And if Ben Affleck doesn't run for Senate against Scott Brown, I'm pitching him on a screenplay about this maple syrup thing. But the thing that's even more amazing about it is that they stole it from literally a global strategic maple syrup reserve run by what amounts to a Canadian cartel. This cartel controls anywhere from 70 to 78% of the world's maple syrup
That's
at any
amazing.
Given time, depending on how the trees are doing. And they actually do, you know, they turn the tap on and off just to affect the amount that's in the marketplace. So, so we don't have maple syrup independence here in America. So tap, baby, tap. Tap, baby, tap.
Love that.
Strategic reserve, is that for the Mayan apocalypse?
Well, I mean, you want to have something good to eat while the world's ending. So,
Meghna, how about your hubbub?
Well, I usually come to the table with a hubbub about the strange animal story of the week or space exploration highlights. But I have to say, what happened in Newtown has really affected me and stayed with me for a long time. And I, my hubbub is a little more serious this weekend. I was looking at the Newtown Bee, which is, of course, a century and a half old newspaper in Newtown, Connecticut, and looking at the obituaries that they have for the 20 children who were killed there at Sandy Hook Elementary School. And just looking at these obituaries, for example, for Charlotte Bacon, was 6 years old, and it describes her as having a beautiful smile and the unique way she expressed her individuality, usually with the color pink, and that she always wanted to be a veterinarian. And for Olivia Rose Engel, who took special pleasure in leading grace with her family every night at the dinner table. And then Noah Posner, who his family describes as impish and larger than life and the light of their family, and asks the question in the obituary, how do you capture the essence of a six-year-old in just a few words? And that really stayed with me, because I thought, usually in obituaries we read things about what folks accomplished in their lives, but here we have an exercise in really trying to understand that it's not what we do that matters, as these 6 and 7-year-olds have shown us, but rather how we live. And as strange as it sounds, I'm grateful to their families for sharing even these little stories about their children to kind of help me learn that lesson about it's really about how we live. So that's my hubbub for this week.
Peter Canellos, let me come to you with your hubbub.
Well, this is a slightly happier story about children. Four middle schools in Boston have participated for the first time last week in a rugby tournament. Rugby is that sport that, you know, British prep schools play and that people in the United States haven't completely embraced except in sort of eccentric pockets of the country. But I would say at a time when there's so many questions about the safety of football and those sort of high velocity hits, and so many questions about heading in soccer and other areas, that trying a new sport for school kids is a good idea. And, you know, if it gives these kids fun and quality recreation, it's a great thing to do.
Well, thanks for that. That's Peter Canellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Peter, thanks, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR in Hartford, thanks so much for joining us, and I wish you and everyone down there in Connecticut a great weekend as well.
Thanks, Anthony. Better days ahead.
Absolutely.
Well, stay with us. We'll talk a little bit more sports regarding the future of the Red Sox and why they're building a mediocre team. Plus, we'll take a look at the story of female law judges and lawyers in Massachusetts. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.